Thinking Basketball Podcast. My name is Ben. Welcome back. Today, we are going to talk about basketball. That's what we're going to do. Cody is here.
Think about it, too.
Cody, how you doing?
I'm doing well. If you can look on your camera, you see that on my eye?
Oh, my goodness. What happened? Cody has a scratch. If this is not available via video for you, some kind of scratch on his eyelid. It looks like, did you run into a cat?
And here's the thing. I watched so much basketball this last week that my eyes started bleeding. Now, that's a joke. I was confused listening to you and Kyle last episode when you're like, people would be confused to find out we actually watch basketball. I was confused by that. I'm like, we actually watch it? I just look at PER and field goal percentage and call it a day.
Oh, that's the old way to do it. I like to look at that dripping matrix code in ones and zeros. You just got to get a stream of data coming into your... What are we talking about today? The fact that there's no defense in the NBA? Is that what we're talking about?
Yeah, I think that's the only place to start. That's what people have been waiting for, is for us to... Now that March Madness is here, the real basketball, the real good basketball in this nation, we need to talk about the NBA not having defense.
I mean, we talked about this last week, of course, the scoring boom, things that are changing with the officiating, both in the long term and the short term, foul rates, stuff like that. But then, of course, this is one thing. I hear this all the time, this sort of idea that there's no defense in today's NBA.
Yeah, I bring up the March Madness thing because this is a conversation I start having a lot more, like between students, between coworkers and things like that. People are all like, oh, have you been watching these games? And I'm like, no, there was a Pistons Magic game the other day. Like, I couldn't watch March Madness. And they're like, oh, the NBA is so like, they don't even try. They don't even try. They haven't played defense in years. And I'm like, what? What is your response when you hear that sort of thing? Like, how do you engage with this conversation in a non-condescending way?
You mean if I were directly talking to someone in that situation?
Yeah.
I would slowly walk them through the strategic arms race of the last 25 years, going back to the rule changes about freedom of movement and the effect of spacing, and the fact that really I think NBA defenses today are in many ways fantastic. They are just hamstrung by both an improvement in strategy and a radical change in officiating that's very lopsided. I think if you went back, here's a question that I was thinking about recently. If you went back in time, like a true time machine thing, you took a team from today with the knowledge they have, the additional knowledge that they've built over the last decade or two, and you brought them back in time, what would an offensive rating, what would an average kind of like offensive rating be against today's defense with everything that they've learned and with everything that they can throw at you? I think it would be much lower. Like, I think the average defense today would be an elite defense like 15 years ago, something like that.
Yeah, that was exactly what I was going to say, and that's what I like talking with you about this kind of stuff, is you have this historical scope too. But if you go back to the 80s, you go back to the 70s, like, the level of effort on the average NBA play from, like, role players on defense, it does not stack up to nowadays. Like, the running through different screens and having to cover the paint and being spread out and closing out and having to cover and pre-switching and all this kind of stuff. Like, I feel like I just didn't see it to the level that I'm seeing it now. Like, NBA defenses are working hard. And if they weren't working hard, the offensive rating would be, like, 125 this season.
Yeah, and we're back to more movement in the game in the last few seasons. And the space, of course, means you have to cover larger distances, big men being stretched to the perimeter. You know, now we see switching schemes and all this kind of stuff. And so the average February game in, like, the 90s or something, when I was growing up watching nightly and League Pass became a thing and stuff like that, you would watch these games in the heart of the season, in the heart of the winter in the Northeast, and there just wasn't that much movement or effort. Those guys were pacing themselves to a certain degree for the postseason, and you had stars back then playing. This is another one that gets me. This is a pet peeve. Wilt Chamberlain played over 48 minutes a game. Yeah, he didn't have to run out and deal with 16 ball screens 30 feet away from the hoop, or Steph Curry and Buddy Hield running around trying to pull up from wherever they could for 21 consecutive seconds. A lot of guys could just go paint to paint. You had a lot more isolation in these past eras, a lot more post offense. So even the packed paint The perimeter players kind of stayed outside. Maybe one of them cut through to change sides. And then you'd have, like, the post guys. They would be like a little wrestling match. One, somebody would set a cross screen for another person. A guard would go through. John Stockton would elbow someone in the leg. Finally, Karl Malone pops out. He gets his post up. Then he can catch it. He can pound it in one place for a few seconds and then go into a fadeaway. Like, the amount of effort and movement and running on that play compared to the first 4 seconds of a Memphis Grizzlies possession, it's like, or the Golden State Warriors, what they're trying to do every few seconds on offense, it's night and day. So I think that effort, I think that movement, the only reason why I believe people are saying there's no defense is because of the psychological effect of looking at the scoreboard, where we have more pace and we have more efficiency. But that efficiency is things like the three-point shot being used, huge, huge uptick in foul rates, allowing offensive players to take more steps, carry the ball more. It's just an evolution of these things. It's like a frog in boiling water. So I think that's what I would say. Was that not condescending?
No, I think that's actually a really good answer. And I do think the looking at the scoreboard, I think it's even beyond that. Like, if you get a lot of your NBA content from watching SportsCenter, because maybe you're a general NBA or general like sports fan, you just turn on SportsCenter and you see like the highlights, you see some people splash some threes and maybe a drive and maybe there's a missed rotation so there's an open layup. You see the scoreboard, but you also see these highlight offensive plays because those are the things that are being shown. And all of a sudden you just jump to the idea of like, oh, they're not trying as hard on defense. And I remember this a lot with like LeBron in like the early 2010s when people are like, oh, Jordan never took a night off. I watched a game from like 88 when he was guarding like Randy Whitman when he was playing for the Hawks, and there was like four straight possessions. Yep. He just gets torched on a ball screen. I'm like, no, this Jordan never took a playoff. No NBA player ever has not taken a playoff. Like, that's
actually
just a fallacy.
Yeah, I just watched that game last year. I know exactly what you're talking about. I think it's in his Greatest Peaks video. He kind of like looks to just leak over to the ball side to get a steal. And then by the third time, he's like not even chasing Randy Whitman off the screen. It's like Randy Whitman's a good shooter. And the whole thing they're trying to do is set a down screen for him so he can come up and get a wide open jumper at 17 feet. And by the third time, you would think you would go after it. And then it happens a fourth time. So, yeah, it's a different game than it was back then. And I think another thing about the perception of highlights that you were just pointing out, it's another psychological effect. These highlights are cut upstream in the play. You don't see what happened earlier in the play. So if you watch a lot of highlights, you might think, wow, there's no defense. Look at how that guy got a wide open dunk down the lane. He got a wide open dunk down the lane because they're like six passes in and they're like seven rotations in. And at the very end, there was, or somewhere there was a breakdown or whatever. And after these long chain of events, sometimes you just can't make that help the helper. You know, you can't make that last rotation. And so you get these incredible modern athletic, and there's more of these guys on the court. There aren't trees, big men, these sluggish guys. So you have these really athletic wings coming in and attacking closeouts, and you get that final breakdown, and they have more space to cover. So they're going and helping all the way out to the corner or on a closeout and trying to recover. You wouldn't see this kind of play over and over again on highlights in the 80s or 90s. And yet, in the 80s or 90s, you would have defensive breakdowns. They would just look a little different. A body would still be nearby, if you will. And there would still be, like, Dikembe Mutombo lurking in the paint. So you couldn't quite have as many wide-open layups at the hoop. All the bigs now can get stretched out to the perimeter. And when you do that, you create space for these wide-open layups. And I think it can create the perception, if you're only viewing the game through that lens, of like, what's going on? This is so easy. There's no defense.
Which is why I think like the misnomer of small ball kind of misses the point, where I like skill ball a lot more, because it's just like these bigger players aren't necessarily getting smaller. Like, you know, we're seeing a lot more big guys out there, like Embiid, Jokic, Giannis. These guys are doing just fine on defense and excelling at defense. But the thing is they can cover so much more ground so much quicker. Like, we see immense defensive impacts from singular big men from 90s, 80s, 70s. And you simply wouldn't see that kind of impact, because like Olajuwon still would be a top tier defender nowadays. But like, he would all of a sudden have to be guarding someone out on the perimeter and have to cover back to the paint and things like that. So I think all of those elements kind of combine to make it seem like defenses are just not trying or worse nowadays.
Well, Tracy McGrady said something, right? He was the one who said something recently about Giannis. Yep. What did he say about him?
So there were two players, two retired players that made comments about Giannis. Tracy McGrady said that it would have been tough for him to be who he is today back then.
Basically, it would have been like, tough for him to be who he is today back then. Okay.
Basically, like, you can't, like, do the spread pick and roll thing. His game is predicated on getting downhill. And back in Tracy McGrady's day, you know, so long ago in 2007, like, it just would have been impossible for him to use that space. And then Charles Oakley, in sort of a follow-up interview a little bit after that, here's his full quote. He said, he wouldn't have been a force back in the day. He would have struggled. They would make him shoot jump shots. He wouldn't be doing a Euro step to the basket. Somebody going to knock his head off. He'd come off the bench back in the day. So Oakley goes a step further and says that Giannis would come off the bench in the 80s and 90s. What is your immediate reaction to that?
Well, I think McGrady's one is interesting because it would have been tougher or even extremely hard for him to play exactly the same way he plays today, because those five-out sets and that space would not really be a thing. And then you have to think about, I think the appropriate way to do it is, or the reasonable way to do it is just to think about how he would develop and what kind of skills he would try to develop. Because when you're coming up 17, 18, 19, second, third year in the league, you're not going to be able to have sort of the learning repetitions to realize, like, oh, I should get this incredible Euro step. I've got these really long limbs and legs, and I can get downhill. I'm really big, but I can move fast into big people, and it's really hard for them to handle, and I'm too strong and long for small people. It would be different because you would not have that five-out runway. I think Giannis with a runway is one of the scariest things in NBA history, and I think it's a big key to his effectiveness as an offensive player. I think it's also why he's so good as a roll man, being able to get downhill and just take that space and eat it up. So right on that cue, I think he would have been a dangerous roll man. There still would have been lob threats in the 90s and 2000s. I think he would have had more post opportunities. I think he probably would have started more stuff. You see it now where he starts stuff around the mid-range, the elbow. I feel like, Cody, what do you think? I feel like they were doing that more a couple of years ago, and now they've become a little bit more selective about, like, you're going to start your move from 17 feet. I feel like he either gets transition, runway, a good touchdown low within the flow of the offense, where now he's added that little fadeaway, which I love, or as a roll man, right? Whereas a couple of years ago, I think more of his stuff was starting sort of around the middle of the foul line. Is that fair?
I think you might be right. I think there was a weird pivot to him initiating a lot more outside of the perimeter, maybe a year ago, a year and a half ago or so. But I do think I've been seeing a little bit more sprinkled in with him starting at the top of the key more. But you're right. He's been acting primarily as a role man, primarily as a transition man, more than I feel like I'm accustomed to seeing this season.
Yeah. So I think, like, on McGrady's perspective, if he weren't being inflammatory, I mean, you know, maybe if he's trying to be fair, he is the type of player that I think it would be different, just like how recently we talked about it would be different for Shaq. Shaq would probably have to play a different way going forward in time. So I think that part is interesting, especially just realizing how players succeed within their context, like what makes something a strength or weakness that generates impact one way or the other within their era, within their context. So that's really interesting. But I think with great players, and Giannis is a world-class freakish athlete, and he's someone who works really hard, and I think despite some of the criticisms last season, has continued to add a little or uptick his game in a fairly normal way for, like, really, really high-level players. No, I don't think he's ever going to be a great shooter. Yes, it took him a little bit too long, in my opinion, to add some of the short mid-range, just that single right shoulder fadeaway. I would have had him working on that shot over threes. I've said this for years. But ball handling, understanding how to use his body in space, passing, vision, accepting double teams, adding, you know, he's got a little hook now, which I think is a little bit more developed. This is normal for guys of this level in their mid-20s, and I think you would have seen, I don't know if he could be the same impact player on offense, but, I mean, I think he would have been a boatload 15 or 20 years ago. So Charles Oakley just, it's a little crazy with the back in my day. Like you're talking about a guy who in some ways is like a bigger, longer version of Dominique Wilkins in terms of the stuff he can do around the basket. I think there would have been more offensive rebounding oomph back in Charles Oakley's day. So I think either way, you're talking about a high-level player. It's a little silly sometimes when these guys say, oh, this 6'11 guy who can do things no one else can do would come off the bench? What? And that doesn't even mention the defense. I mean, like, he would – I think you mentioned this recently. He'd probably even be more impactful as a defender 15 or 25 years ago.
Yeah, absolutely. That's what I was going to say, is maybe you took a little bit off the offensive end.
Right.
Like, defensively, like, we're talking about now a guy that doesn't have to go out on the perimeter and cover all this space. We're just stationing, like, literally one of the best rim protectors in the league, who's also just a tremendous off-ball roamer, like, closer to the basket, not having to do more duties. But then also, just like, on offense, people complain nowadays about him being too physical. Right? Like, teams, like, I feel like there was a Hawks game semi-recently where, like, everyone was freaking out. Like, oh, he's, like, throwing his elbow into Clint Capella, and he's just, like, driving to the basket, right? He took it straight to Rudy Gobert a couple of times recently against the Jazz. Like, this is a guy that does not shy away from content. Content. That was weird. I don't know if he shies away from content.
He likes content. No, his content is very, very good.
Yeah, Giannis is the great content. He does not shy away from content or contact. Right. And so if he'd grown up in a different context, we have lots of those kinds of words right now. If he had been in a different context, right, he would have been working on that jump hook more, which looks, like you said, pretty effective. He would have had a nice little 10-foot fadeaway, which he seems to have right now. Like, this guy would have figured it out and been, I don't know, maybe not as effective offensively, but definitely more effective defensively. And we still end up with an all-time player no matter what.
Yeah, I think something like that. Now, you can debate whether there's an era that makes an all-time player a top 25 player in history or a top 75 player in history, but I think that's kind of moot when we get to a point like, back in my day, this guy would really struggle or really come off the bench. It's like, come on. Anyway, you know who's not struggling? Like, Giannis right now. He's been fantastic again as of late, and the stuff, I mean, we were just talking about using him as a role man and the way Milwaukee uses him. Their offense, especially with the big three, has really been humming. Do you want to, I mean, you're the resident, I don't want to step on your resident Bucks fandom here. How are you feeling about this offense? Let's start with that.
I'm really excited about it, and you might need to taper me down because I have a couple of takes. I have a couple of takes coming up here. Maybe they'll be a little too ridiculous, but
it's not like I get in trouble when you have ridiculous takes. So just fire away.
See, that's what's great is any voice you hear, that's Ben's voice. So at him, right? I don't even exist. Go straight to Ben with any takes. But yeah, over the last 15 games, I'm not counting the stinker against the Timberwolves yesterday. I didn't even watch the game because it's blacked out, and I'm a good, upstanding citizen that doesn't bypass blacking out in any way. That's not even sarcasm. I don't know.
The Timberwolves, we're going to have to do something with the Timberwolves because I'm not mentally prepared for this. I just saw, like, an hour ago, their offensive rating since January 1st is over 120. Best in the NBA. I don't know. Can anybody beat Minnesota? All right, back. Continue, Cody. I'm sorry. You were saying you get blacked out. You can't watch your local team.
Yeah, so Giannis is out yesterday against the Timberwolves. But the previous 15 games, they had the best offense in the NBA. Their offensive rating was the best. I think it was just a shade under 120 at that point. And I was going in
Timberwolves level offense.
Yeah, the Bucks are basically as good as the Timberwolves in offense. That's all you need to know. There's like the Timberwolves, the Grizzlies, and the Bucks. So that's when you know it's like apex level offense. The thing that really stands out to me is just like they have so much going on, like the big three, and I think combined with the underrated sets that Coach Budenholzer sets up and just like being able to get his guys moving and buying into the system, I don't know, am I going too far to start off by saying that this might be the most diverse offense in the league in terms of like they can throw pretty much any kind of offense at you and they're going to do it at least above average no matter what?
Well, that's an interesting I mean, not the first time you've raised an interesting philosophical question. Would you rather have a handful of brown belts or a black belt or two? Because I don't think the Bucks can give you any form of offense that is like, this is one of the best two or three forms of this offense. But I think they can give you good offense in a variety of different ways. And I'm thinking the way they use Giannis as a role man, five out, Chris Middleton kind of sets. What else, Cody, do they like to run as sort of pet action and offense?
Well, I think the main thing that really stands out to me, I want to push back on that one thing. I think one thing that they do at a top tier level is transition. Because
Giannis, that's true. Yep.
Yeah, Giannis is probably the best transition player in the league right now.
Yep, I'm sorry. I was only thinking of half court. That's a great point. Continue. Giannis in transition is scary.
Yeah, he's absolutely ridiculous. The amount of possessions he gets is like overshadowing pretty much everyone, and he's a foul drawing machine there. But I think the other thing is you know, they have multiple of these wrinkles. I'm thinking of this one set where like it's an out of bounds play, and Chris Middleton gets it, and the first option is he runs off this double stagger baseline, and it's like, oh, we have Chris Middleton coming off a double stagger, him getting a catch and shoot in that situation. That right there is great offense. But that's covered pretty well. You know what the backup plan was? A pick and roll with Jrue Holiday and Giannis Antetokounmpo. So they cover that pretty well. Ends up stifling that a little bit. Giannis ends up, drives into the post, kicks it out, and the possession ends with Jrue Holiday posting up. I think there's maybe one defender weak side there, so he has a lot of space to operate in the post, and he easily rises up and hit a post fadeaway. Okay, so even if you stifle pretty much any action that they have, Chris Middleton, top-tier bad shot maker, Jrue Holiday, underrated post-up mid-range guy, and I mean, this guy is just on fire from mid-range this season. I think the post-up game of his isn't a mirage at all. I think maybe the long mid-range stuff is a little bit of an illusion, but that post game is incredible. So even when it gets bogged down, you have these couple of options that's like, well, didn't work out. Chris, Jrue, go do something. And having that final option, I think, makes them particularly dangerous at this point.
I think they've struggled a little in the past to blend all those things together on one possession, like you just diagrammed, right? And we should talk more about Jrue in a second because he's been amazing. But I think the more you can find sort of organic flowing offensive sets like that, that can take advantage of Giannis attacking space or Giannis getting downhill as a roll man, the spacing and shooting around them with ball handlers who can kick out and make decisions. Chris Middleton in that like pinch post, mid post game, going to his office or using him as one of the guys who can come off. I like all that little middle handoff action they get into sometimes where you can have Jrue or Chris playing kind of two-man action with Giannis and you can hit him on the roll, or you have to respect those guys on the drive and the mid-range pull-up, or you have to respect those guys from three-point shooting because they're both really good three-point shooters. Jrue Holiday specifically has improved his three-point shooting over the years. He's now actually, I think he's like 41% on wide open threes. He's 38% on pull-up threes. Both of those are over the last three seasons. So I like anything this year that can kind of connect the strengths of those three players in a consecutive set organically and leverage the sort of big three offensive options with the role players all at the same time versus like, oh, on this possession, everyone kind of clear out. We're going to isolate Middleton because that's what we need to do.
100. This is something that I've been calling for a couple of years because I think the Bucks offense is worst when they start being like, all right, Giannis, we actually want you to be LeBron light. Like, we're going to space out offense. Giannis, you're going to make something out of it. Maybe we'll get some drive and kick action because I think that's what Budenholzer really likes. That's what he was running with the Hawks a lot, is like, get into the paint, drive, kick, drive, kick, drive, kick. Something is open. And I actually, that's the offense that makes me the most frustrated when the Bucks do this, because I think Giannis still has a poor propensity to take his little pull-up jumpers. I would love for him to cut that fat out of his game. But the best is when he kind of takes on more of like a BAM role versus more of a LeBron role. Like him, top of the key, setting a bunch of screens, doing a bunch of DHOs, letting Chris and Jrue run around. Pretty much everyone else that's on the court with him, Bobby Portis included, even Brooke Lopez now that he's back, everyone else is going to be able to space out and shoot threes. So the paint is just going to be wide open. All these guys are athletic enough to get to the paint. And again, like Middleton, Holiday, these aren't necessarily guys that you can wall off on drives because they're just fine, like stopping short 10 feet and like, well, there's not really a lane going all the way, so I'm going to stop and do a little turnaround. And then Giannis rim running. Like, once you have all of this motion going on and you have the paint wide open, Giannis might be the best lob finisher in the league right now. Like, if he's not, he's absolutely top-tier 99th percentile in that specific skill.
You just said something that kind of made it click for me, which is Giannis, he's kind of like the head of the snake in transition and early offense. And that's organic for them because that plays to his strengths while allowing the other guys to organize on the court as Giannis applies pressure. as that gets choked off a little bit and as the shot clock changes, maybe that moves to Drew Holiday playing more of a traditional point guard. Drew Holiday, of course, is a really nice passer, and then he can kind of use that strength and power if he has a mismatch to get into the teeth of the defense or back someone down. He's just so good at that power post-up game for a guard. And then as you move later into the shot clock, having the ball near or in Chris Middleton's hands allows him to quickly flow two-man game into a post-up or some kind of isolation at the end of the clock. And he's, you know, a fantastic bad shot maker. He's one of your best bad shot makers in the league, maybe. He's really skilled at that. And if you kind of think about the Bucks offense organically working like that, flowing from early offense with Giannis on the ball to Drew in maybe the primary set in an organized half-court set on the ball to Chris Middleton as a release valve at the end of the possession on the ball, then you get this thing that can become kind of greater than the sum of its parts versus, like, we have to pick which one of the three stars, or we have to pick which way to play. We have to play Helio Giannis or something, which, as we've seen, can have serious limitations in the playoffs because teams kind of learn how to build the wall. They could get comfortable with the timing off the corners. Another thing is they sit on that spin move. They know when to sit on his spin move when he comes in the lane. So I really like this version we're describing now. And just to put some numbers on this, Drew Holiday, as of today or yesterday, whenever this is updated, the Bucks offensive rating with him on the court this season is 120.5. So we are in elite territory, and we always talk about looking at it with the kind of big three indicators on the floor. It's been really good.
Let me add a little bit more Drew Holiday numbers there. And I know Zach Lowe and Marcus Johnson were just talking about this on the Low Post. Shout out Marcus Johnson, like Bucks
Marcus
legend.
Johnson's great.
Marcus Johnson is a great play caller. He's a great podcaster. He's a great player. We all need to respect Marcus Johnson more. He's fantastic.
Can we have a breakout Marcus Johnson like love fest at the end of this show? I always thought he was one of the most underrated players of his era because, one, it was short, and then, two, he went to the Clippers and got injured, and it ended very kind of abruptly. And so people don't realize how, not just how good he was, but that he would go toe-to-toe with guys like Julius Erving at sort of the beginning of the 80s, end of the 70s, those old Bucks teams with Bob Lanier. Anyway, Cody's about to start talking about John McLaughlin and Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, so we should get back on track.
Okay, so Drew Holiday. Anyway, what I was saying about the Low Post is Zach Lowe. I think this is a direct response to me. So Zach, thank you so much for responding. This is actually my response to you. And he was like, people get really excited when you just look at the all three of the big three are on the court numbers, which I think I cited like the last episode. Let me go a step further, right? So when the big three, when Giannis, Holiday, and Middleton are all on the court, the relative offense of rating is like plus 11, which I think puts you right around like 122 offensive rating. You take Giannis out of that equation, their offense actually improves a shade. It improves a shade. It's still hovering around that 122. You take Middleton.
Hold on. That's with Giannis on the bench and Chris Middleton and Drew Holiday on the court.
Yes.
Exactly. Do you know how many minutes that is for?
Not off the top of my head. I don't know why I didn't include that with the data, but it's not insignificant. Like it's a pretty solid sample size.
Okay, you keep going. I will see if we can get someone to fetch that while you're talking.
Yeah, you pull that up. If you have Giannis and Holiday on the court together with Middleton off, their offense is still better yet, right? It's like plus 11.47. So we have like 122, no matter what combination of Holiday and the other one of the big three you have. And then even if Giannis and Middleton are off the court together, their offense is like just about plus one, right? Like it's not great, but it's still not sinking. Like Holiday is still able to keep them above water a little bit. And here's what Holiday is averaging in those minutes without the other two. He's averaging per 75, 31.5 points with a true shooting that's plus 4 percentage points better than league average and 9.5 points, 9.5 assists per 75. All right, so Drew Holiday, like I've talked about this a lot. Shiftability. Drew Holiday is tremendous at shifting role, right? Like he can slot in next to these other stars. He's great next to Middleton and Giannis. But when you start taking away those other offensive options, he becomes more of the focal point. He's able to ramp up his scoring and passing and efficiency enough that he can still buoy a solid offense. So I think that Drew Holiday offensively right now has been the true key of their success this season.
And by the way, it's 421 minutes that sample with Jrue Holiday and Chris Middleton. Without Giannis, and the Bucks are plus 8 per 100 in that sample, which is pretty impressive. And back to Jrue, I agree. I think he's someone who I was lower on offensively in the past, and of course, for a lot of the playoffs last season, really struggled with shot making and just overall kind of offensive grooving as they ground through that postseason championship run ultimately. But if you look at his time in Milwaukee, both last season and this season, he, as we've said, has shot the ball much better. His overall indicators, his scoring efficiency, everything's kind of been up. And then this season, he's been a little bit better than last season. Like I mentioned, three-point shooting numbers. Cody alluded to it earlier. He's been really good in the mid-range, short mid-range. We talked about all his strengths. We talked about him as a passer. 20 points per 75, plus 3% relative true shooting compared to the league. His one-number metrics look good. I mean, I think if I had to pick a team today for the playoffs, I think the Bucks would have three of my top 20 picks.
Wait, what do you mean by three of your top 20 picks? What do you mean by that?
If I had a draft board for picking a team for the postseason, I think they have three of the top 20 players on that draft board.
Oh, wow. Okay, yeah. So you like Jrue and Chris that much along with
I've been a big Chris fan for a long time. I think he's often been closer to a, you know, fringe top 10 player, depending on who's healthy and who's in the league, than some people. Like, it always confuses me when people are like, yeah, Chris Middleton's not an all-star. He's not one of the 30 best players in the league. I'm not going to call out any of the players who made the all-star team over them, because it's just not going to do anybody any good at this point. But there's plenty of guys I would take him over plenty of the guys who have made an all-star team this season.
Yeah. Absolutely. And it feels like the thing is like when we're talking about their offense meshing together, it almost feels like an unselfishness of those three. Like we don't hear any chirping about needing a bigger role or wanting to score more points, because clearly Jrue can do it. You've tweeted out multiple times evidence of Chris being able to ramp up his scoring and creation when he doesn't have superstars, but they don't care. Like they seem to be just fine, like as long as their offense is going well. Now, like I said, Giannis still has those bumps and bruises of trying to take those pull-up threes and pull-up mid-ranges, which I think that's the main thing holding back his offense right now. Is instead of dishing it off to one of the other two guys to create, he kind of takes it into his hands sometimes. I really don't love that. But I have a historical comparison for Jrue right
now. Ooh.
Okay.
Go for it.
I'm going to throw this out there. This might be extremely blasphemous. You might need to pull me back here. But this is based solely on what I'm seeing. Jrue Holiday's offensive game right now reminds me a little bit of Oscar Robertson. Okay, that mid-range maestro, the like slow-paced establishing yourself. Both of them are just these strong guards that can take other guards into the post and aren't like getting mismatched in the post at all. And when I was watching them, I'm like, yeah, this is how I imagine Oscar Robertson would be playing if he was in the league right now.
Have you not had enough sunlight lately?
On the contrary,
what's the weather like?
It's been like the sunniest
Minnesota.
It's been the sunniest. I've got some color on my face. I got some energy again. Jrue Holiday reminds me of a Oscar Robertson's game.
I'm gonna let that one stand. I mean, I if you're talking about a much lighter, less effective version, because he can't pass. He can't pass like Oscar Robertson.
I'm not
he can't
saying
shoot.
Drew, yeah. I'm not saying Jrue Holiday is as effective as Oscar Robertson, but that play style, the way that he is
got it
playing on the court, the way that he's making himself more efficient, reminds me of Oscar's game.
Okay. I mean, Oscar liked to operate a lot in the kind of middle of the floor. He used his body, his hips, his rump extremely well. Has anyone said rump in the year 2022? I believe I'm the first one to... Oh, man. This is being recorded, Ben. I get what you're saying. Both using a lot of power, doing a lot of work in that kind of inside 15 feet, which, of course, isn't super common today. I'll let it. You know, the Bucks, we're feeling good. The Bucks are doing well. I think we should give Cody this one.
Okay. Thank you. I appreciate this. This is me, like, the opposite of being vindicated, whatever it is. I was very critical of Jrue last year. Like, the playoff run last year, he was like a negative 10 efficiency. I was really critical of the trade at first. I said a lot of mean things about him in the playoffs. I've done a complete 180. Like, Jrue Holiday, tell me if you're wrong. Do you think this is Jrue Holiday's best season?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I don't know how sustainable the offense is, but I think it's definitely been his best regular season. And I think if his offensive game, this is kind of close to a stabilizing point for his offensive game. It doesn't regress back down too much. and his defense is still there, I think this is not only absolutely the best version of Drew Holiday, but like I said, I mean, that's definitely a top 20 player, I think. He's if you haven't been paying attention, he's just really been fantastic this year.
Yeah, exactly. Like, go watch a Bucks game. You will be shocked at how efficiently Drew ends up just using his strength in the post, setting up guys with not traditional drive and kick game, because he's not going to be super quick. Like, there's even, I think it was against the Jazz, there's a play where, like, he drives. Is it against Clarkson, maybe? Anyway, he draws a foul, but it's not because of his speed. It's not because of a quick first step. He just really gets into him. And it's almost one of those where I'm sitting there watching and I'm like, dude, just flop a little bit. Like, sell the contact, get to the line. But he's just not. He's just a bear driving into the post, being at 6'4", or whatever he is.
We're going to set up a poll. I think on Spotify, you can set up a poll and we'll let people know. I mean, people will let us know if your Oscar Robertson comparison is okay. We'll set up a poll and get feedback on that. Is there anything else we have to talk about? You wanted to ask me a question.
I did.
You wanted to ask me a question after the last LeBron James video. Is that right?
Yeah, 100%. So you want to talk about transition, guys. It blows my mind that LeBron is still second in transition possessions of players that have played 40 games. Like, at 37, that doesn't even make sense.
Well, I think he's the greatest transition. I mean, a Magic would be the only other kind of contender, I think, but I think he's the best transition scorer ever, and I think he's probably the best transition player ever.
Yeah, I think I agree with that. I think I used to think a 1A, 1B with Magic, but I think LeBron's scoring puts him up a level. But I was thinking about his game, and just like this year, thinking back to his prime being such a focal point of an offense. Like, he's one of those heliocentric kind of guys where it's like you almost don't want the ball in other people's hands because he's just so good with the ball. And I was thinking, like, what kinds of players do you actually want to pair up with LeBron? Like, if you were trying to build the ideal teammate for LeBron James, I mean, usually you want multiple ball handlers, but do you want multiple ball handlers when you have LeBron out there? So if you were to have an ideal teammate for LeBron James, you can think this season historically, either what kind of archetype would you go with, or what player comes to mind for that?
The archetype is a pick and roll, pick and pop partner who could also space the floor and then provide insane defensive value on the other end. It's one of the reasons why I think Anthony Davis was probably the best fitting teammate of his entire career. And then I think if I'm following the logic and I'm consistent, that means I think your best teammate would be, I get to pick from anyone in history?
Anyone in history.
Yeah, probably someone like Kevin Garnett then.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, I get that. I feel like Kevin Garnett would be the answer for a lot of players.
Well, that's honestly why he's Kevin Garnett.
That's true. Yeah. I got another player for you. I don't know if this player is too good, but I'm thinking of like offensive synergy where if you had these two on the court at the same time, it just wouldn't be fair. How would you feel about like Steph Curry versus Kevin Garnett?
Well, I don't think I think you'd have to think about how you construct the defense a little differently on the other end. And then Steph Curry is interesting, because the question is, I assume you're asking for this reason. The question is, can you still kind of harness all of his movement off the ball where you've got, at least one or two other players kind of screening and moving with him while LeBron has it up top? Is LeBron playing pick and roll, or is he just by himself at the elbow? Like, by the way, I think one of the traps we fall into when we talk like this is we assume a team is running like one or two sets over. There's a lot more diversity than that. But just conceptually, the geometry of the floor, I think I would wonder how it would work. I think with Curry, I like another mover. I like other shooters. I would rather have. I love the model with Draymond and Andre Iguodala, by the way, and before that, Andrew Bogut to some degree, and even Zaza Pachulia, and just these guys who are like your worst offensive players in some classical sense, being the feeders of Curry and the other guys moving, and it's kind of the Heat can do it as well, where if you give the ball to Bam, who's your weakest shooter, you can have all these other guys move around and create chaos. I don't know how that would work with LeBron. I think it would be great, but I wonder if you get a better deal having a great defensive player and a pick and roll partner that kind of enhances the classical LeBron ball. I don't know. What do you think?
Yeah, I think I buy that, especially like because I am just talking about offensive synergy, and if you unlocked it, that would be incredible. But the defensive synergy between KG and LeBron, like if you had LeBron at the four and KG at the five, like, oh my God, like that's
that's the one I get more excited about almost. Yeah.
Yeah. So that was the main question I had. Do you have anything else?
No, I think, have we covered our bases for today? Is there anything else we need to talk about?
Do you want to talk about Marcus Johnson?
Oh, the Marcus Johnson Love Fest.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe not a classical top three, top five player at his peak, but like really good scorer, slasher, can kind of get into the mid-range stuff, probably a better passer than you would imagine. Like, Cody, who's almost a functional comparison historically, like Tracy McGrady or something, where you get some scoring and playmaking? I think McGrady was a better pure passer. McGrady was a really good passer, by the way. But then Marcus was a better defender than you think, that kind of thing. I don't know. He was just a really good NBA forward, like a great NBA forward from 1979 to 1982 or 83 or something.
I think the guy that comes to mind for me is like Blake Griffin. Like, I feel like they were kind of in the same mold, especially in like the fact that they were bigger. They handled a lot more. I think I could be wrong about this. I heard it from Paul Pressey in 80s games to watch, but I think someone tweeted at me some evidence that Marcus Johnson might have been the first player that somebody referred to as a point forward.
Mm, yep. I think, so funny because Paul Pressey is like the one I think of as being a quintessential point forward for the Bucks.
Yeah, that's exactly it. It's like he's more of the typical like starting the possession. I think they just called it for Marcus Johnson because he was good at like the grab and go. Like he would palm the ball out of rebounds. I tweeted a highlight of him like boxing out Daryl Dawkins, and he goes up and just like one hand cups it and brings it down, and he himself actually retweeted it. It's like, oh, I had to keep it away from Daryl at times because he was just so physical down there, and this is the only way that I could do it. So I think the grab and go is what made him the first point forward.
Have you seen Winning Time?
No, I haven't.
Okay. All right. We probably should talk about that.
Is he in
at
it?
At some point. No, he's not in it yet. It's Sidney Moncrief has come up, and then the Magic Johnson thing where in the first episode at least one of the issues with Winning Time is so much of it seems to be non-factual, and yet it's presented as kind of like a historical account of what happened. But there is this tension that was real at the time, and you can read a little bit about it in past articles of, you know, whether Magic comes with risks and whether there's ever been a player like Magic. It's kind of what Kyle Mann and I were talking about in the last episode, where really at the end of the day it's some kind of like black swan fallacy. You haven't seen this new type of player, so therefore that you can't see how they would be really, really successful, and you can see all the ways that they fail compared to other players, therefore they might be more likely to fail. And having a 6'8 point guard back then was essentially completely unheard of, and so there was this pressure to take Sidney Moncrief with the number one pick, and Moncrief also ended up becoming a very good player. We've talked about him this year on the podcast. Anyway, We'll have to dig into Winning Time at some point.
Definitely. I have some. This is speaking of completely factual texts. Somebody, when I was talking about point forwards on Twitter once upon a time, someone tweeted me the etymology of the word from Wikipedia. And it seems like here are the conflicting stories. It looks like Marcus Johnson claims that he invented it in the 84 playoffs because they were short on point guards after Nate Archibald was sidelined. And when Don Nelson told him to initiate the offense, Marcus Johnson was like, all right, so instead of a point guard, I'm a point forward. Del Harris, one of the assistant coaches for the Bucks at the time, claims that he first mentioned it to Don Nelson in reference to Paul Pressey. But then there's this twist where somebody credits, I think, Tom Nesselke, Rockets coach, using it for Rick Barry as a point forward. So those seem to be the three names that come up on Wikipedia, at least.
And what is that, 79, like end of the 70s that would be for Rick Barry? 79 or 80 or something?
Yeah, they don't give a date for that one.
But okay. All right, yeah. So sometime around then, point forward was invented. That's what we're going with today.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
All right, if you want to support this podcast and maybe contribute to our continuing to research the etymology of terms like point forward, check out patreon.com/thinkingbasketball. It's the best way to directly contribute, and we have all sorts of fun additional content, articles, additional videos. We have a fun post show from the last podcast episode with Kyle Mann. patreon.com/thinkingbasketball. for Cody, you know, thanks for listening all the way to the end with us. I hope you enjoyed this one. And of course, wherever you are listening, I hope you're having a great day.